Hey, what's up? This is Jordan Wagner with PremierGuitar.com, and I'm here today in Electrical Audio Studios in Chicago, Illinois, with Russian Circles as they're recording their fifth studio record. And here with me is Mike Sullivan, the guitarist in Russian Circles, and he is going to show us his rig and his gear that he's using to record their new record. So do you want to go ahead and start us off with your amps over here?
Sure. The main amp I've used so far, live and also in the studio, is this Varelin Laux. It's loosely similar to a kind of a high watt vibe. It's EL34s, and it's got two channels, but I just use the clean channel, and it can go pretty loud before it breaks up. So first thing I do when I get an amp is dial in a good clean tone. How loud can I go? And then use that as a foundation to start stacking the piles up on top of there for distortion and whatnot. But yeah, it's just a great, clean, overall clean loud amp, you know, so it's very dark too. So it ends up the bass will be insanely low. I'll feel insecure about it, how low the knob is, but it's just a naturally really dark amp.
Okay. And you're compensating for the low end with the Meat Smoke over here, right?
Yeah, the Meat Smoke is 300 watts powered by 6550s. So it's kind of a bass amp more so than a guitar amp. But again, that's also a very, very dark tonally amp. So it actually can go a lot louder, nature of, you know, being, you know, 300 watts and whatnot. But yeah, tonally a lot different than the Laux. In studio, I find myself using the Laux more often, but live, the Meat Smoke, all the time. The Meat Smoke and Laux are the two main amps when playing live.
Cool. And you're running them through these two Emperor 412s right now. Can you tell us a little bit more about Emperor?
Yeah, Emperor are some good folks here in Chicago that started making amps a few years ago, and they're good about hooking up the bodies of theirs, and anybody who's in a band, they seem to take care of. So they're connected with the Weber folks making speakers. So I have a pair of 80 watt Webers in each of these, and yeah, Emperor has been there since we started, and they kind of helped us out from the ground up. So yeah, we're happy to use their stuff. It sounds great. So I actually have an Emperor head that we've been using on and off too. It's a prototype voice, similar to high watt also, where it's dark, and but you can still dial in a lot of usable bright tones as well.
So you have some additional amps here that you're also using in the studio to add some additional textures. So you have a Tweed Fender Pro Junior, and you have this old Fender Bassman here. And can you give us a little bit more detail on what these are basically adding to
Sure.
your tone?
It's basically a matter of necessity. A lot of the amps were really great sounding, but they all had that dark 412 pop, you know, powered by a loud 100 watt head or so. And at a certain point, it's just canceling each other out, you know? So we needed a different tone, something a little bit brighter. And the Pro Junior fit the bill perfectly, actually. I was shocked by it. Every track, which track is that? Turn that up. Oh, it's a Pro Junior. Son of a bitch, that thing sounds all right. So usually that every track has that in there somewhere, just that speaker breaks up differently and it's more of a direct tone. So live, I can't say I'd ever use it, or who knows, but it's good alongside the other 412 sound. So, and similar with other Fenders we have laying around, the baseband, just a different voice than the Meat Smoke or the Laux. So, and then we have a Fender Twin Reverb here just for general clean tones. Can't go wrong with that. So that's been useful. Each song has seemed to have a different setup, to be honest. We'll pull something out and, oh, plug this in. It's nice luxury. So
the two Varelins with both the Emperor cabs are kind of like the core of everything that you're doing here, and you're just kind of like changing in and out other amps around it to kind
exactly.
of add different
yeah.
textures.
Those things nail that sound great. So what else can I bring in that's not already on the table? So,
can you tell us some about your guitars here?
Sure. As far as main guitars I use, this is a 57 Les Paul reissue. I love the neck. It's a huge baseball bat of a neck, and that's my new comfortable go-to for guitars. I've had some injuries in the past where a flat neck, I just can't play anymore. All of a sudden, pain starts shooting out my arm. So it's half a matter of necessity, actually, but I love them. It's got sustain for days, all that stuff, and I love the weight. The ebony helps for when you have a lot of distortion. It really cuts through, articulates the notes still. So,
and there are different pickups than the stock ones, right?
Yeah. For better or for worse, I've settled on the Gibson Dirty Fingers, which works great for my application. It's just a really loud, bassy, mid-rangey pickup. It's not too brittle, shockingly. So I was surprised how well it worked. I dropped it in there. So that, I've been pleased with that. It cleans up nicely too, which I was also surprised by. And the neck is a 498 treble pickup. And that was the idea with that was just to kind of give a little more brightness and mids because it's a neck pickup and it's all mahogany guitar. So I want to try to brighten it up a little bit. And it's good. It's a loud pickup, but it works, you know, as its purpose.
And you do some other custom modifications to your guitars as well because you don't like shiny finishes. So you take some sort of a abrasive pad to the finish to kind of give it this satin feel and look to it.
Yeah, I like it to be as dull as I am. That's the idea. For some reason, I'm never a fan of really bright guitars. So I just kind of like, let's take that luster out a little bit. And just a aesthetic thing, I suppose. But it's all part of the overall comfort, you know.
And you just added this Flying V to your collection recently, right?
Yeah, it's something different. I've always loved Vs. And that's a 67 reissue. And every guitar player should have a whammy bar at some point, I suppose. So here we go. It's a cool guitar. It's got a great neck. It's a lot thinner, like, as far as the width of the fretboard, I should say. But still a rather fat neck, and it sounds different. It's a very dark guitar, nature of it being all mahogany and rosewood fretboard. But it's cool. I love it. It's one of the most comfortable guitars. I'm at home. I pick that up, and it's only weighs 6.5 pounds, which is a total difference to the Les Paul. So occasionally that's a good guitar to go for. But yeah, I'm having fun with that one.
Does it have the same pickup configuration as the Les Paul?
Similar. It has a Dirty Fingers in the bridge, and I believe it's a 57 Classic in the neck.
Okay. Cool. And then here we have one of your other main Les Pauls. It's a black 57 custom, correct?
Yeah. With this new record, we've started using different tunings that we haven't used before, so it's good to have different guitars, different gauges and all that. So this one's typically for lower tunings and same pickups otherwise, other than the neck pickup has a 490 rhythm. So this guy's buddy ended up being in that pickup and it works out well for some reason. So that with Dirty Fingers satisfies my needs. So yeah, I love, again, that black guitar and this red Les Paul are the best guitars I've ever owned. And I had an old Les Paul custom that I used for all of distortion for the first few records, and the neck ended up giving me issues with the hand pain, so I just bought a similar one with a fatter neck, and couldn't be happier. So all the other guitars have been sold and moved on, so I'm happy with, you know, these Les Pauls.
And you just got a new custom-ordered Fano in, right?
Yeah, I'm really happy with that. I just got that about a month ago or so. I used to play a Jazzmaster often for overdubs and for certain songs live, which was great, but it wasn't the highest quality of Jazzmaster, to say the least. And this was just bought to kind of fill that void and a better version of that. And I couldn't be happier. It's got a shorter scale, more of a Gibson-type feel, really fat neck, surprisingly. Lawler pickups, which I'm surprised by. I never played them until this guitar, and I was shocked how clear they are, how loud they are too, for being, you know, original P90s kind of tone. But yeah, I'm impressed by those. And yeah, it's a great guitar. I had a few custom things as far as I like black guitars and I like certain binding in the body and not the neck with that one. And yeah, I'm surprised how comfortable it is for a new guitar. It feels great.
All of these guitars have had their control knobs replaced with a very specific type of control knob. What was your reasoning behind that?
When I play live, I have disgusting, sweaty, gross, clammy, cold hands. And to combat that, you need some sort of grip on the knob. So that's just an easy way. I can just tell where I am, easily reach down, move the tone, adjust the volume. And a tone is incredibly useful, that knob, for dialing DAC a little, if it's a little bit, you know, too bright. But more importantly, I use it for feedback. Without that tone, feedback would be a lot more difficult to control. So yeah, and the line helps you tell right where you are, so it's a convenience thing for me, but now I'm addicted to those knobs, so.
And here we got your pedal board here, which is pretty expansive. I know you've been changing things in and out since you've been in the studio, but there is a lot on here that's basically mm-hmm. kind of the core of what you use live. Can you start off by describing what is your basic core live components of this board, and then kind of expand upon that from what you've been adding and using in the studio?
Sure. Well, what we see here is a lot of dirt pedals, I'm realizing. this is more for recording setup, but so typically I have an amp set up pretty loud to a clean, barely break up. And so I don't mess with the delay settings and all that. I don't change channels on the amp. So I'm recently using these two Mesa pedals, the Tone Burst and the Flux Drive, together at the same time, using a little looper to turn them on and off. And I couldn't be happier as far as trying to get a tone that matches almost a second channel of an amp. It doesn't just sound like a few fuzz pedals smash in the front end, you know? For some reason, they did a great job filling that void that other dirt pedals didn't really sound like another channel. So those are usually my go-to for conventional overdrive tone. But on a similar note, this BB preamp, the Andy Timmons model, that kind of changed my whole thought, I guess, on distortion, because that's got such clear articulation and made me reassess the distorted tone. So it's a different tone than the Mesa pedals, but it has its application for sure. So I like that pedal a lot. And the Secret Freak, I have that kind of towards the beginning. That's a great mid-range boost. So you step on that. Yeah, I already have enough gain and crap going on, but that kind of helps sound like more distortion, even though it's not all that much. It just gives it a little more mid-range boost, and that's pretty effective, actually. I like that. It's a Fuzz Factory that some friends at Zvex painted a hockey rink on there. Even if that thing sounds great, even if it sounded like crap, I'll still put it in there because it has a hockey rink on it. But that's a great pedal just for out-of-control fuzz. It blends well with other pedals, but that's really a good go-to pedal for over-the-top fuzz sounds. I picked up a few Strymon effects. I used to always use a Deluxe Memory Man. I've used them for years, but just a few months ago, I picked this up, and it's a much cleaner kind of sound to it. It doesn't have as much noise and hiss. I still love Memory Man, but this has similar use, but not as temperamental, I suppose. And on the same page, that Flint by Strymon, awesome reverb. I've been going to town on that. The really cool feature, you can do that. Set this to 80s decay, or the decay up, and 80s, and check out, and go to Brian Eno country, and just, you're gone forever. It's a lot of fun. It's very good for ambient use, and a very usable tremolo, too. So that's a, yeah, very cool pedal.
And you're splitting these out from that Maxon CS9 Chorus?
Yeah, this is kind of a studio-only kind of operation. I usually have like a couple 412s going through the pedal chain, and then this will split here and go to like a drier signal, go to one of the Fender amps. And then right now I have this Reaper pedal, using that for reverb and delay on this little mini chain. It's hard to tell what's going on here, but there's actually two different pedal board chains happening here for recording sake. Yeah, I have that head rush I use a lot live for live looping.
And you're a pretty big proponent of the Digitech Jamman loopers, right?
Yeah, those are good. They're good for if you have a saved loop for something, or interlude, or in a loop on top of a loop. That's, yeah, I have a loop going in the Jamman, in the head rush, I can always loop that with another loop on the Jamman. So
you daisy chain your loops with...
Yeah, you can have some fun with that, and you can get really noisy if you want to. You stack different loops in different times and create some funky noises. So, yeah.
So one of the things that Russian Circles is known for, especially through your guitar technique, is you have a very interesting way of looping and tapping and creating these intricate melodies that you have a very masterful way of controlling. Like Death Rides a Horse, for example, off of Enter, is a great example of this. What kind of led to that sort of technique that you developed? Because it's very distinctive, and it's not really like in the classical like 80s shred sense of tapping.
Yeah, I could never pull that off all the way, so I had to find another way to do that, find a niche. I always, loved Metallica and Van Halen, all that back in the day. So I was always a fan of, Van Halen sounded like the future to me, always. No matter what year it was, he was 10 years ahead of me, or in my headspace. Like, this is music from a different planet. So, and it's always in a classical kind of note choice, with where he came from. And then it just got kind of bastardized by watered down copy, stuff. And people did cool stuff with it, but it's fun to deviate from the norm and kind of don't play the safe pentatonic notes and just reach for different notes that still you want to hear in your head. Mm-hmm. People often get caught in just doing like the... or whatever, that kind of variation. but I became a fan of just kind of playing a chord progression with your left hand and then moving that around. I'll just play like Death Rides a Horse. That's kind of using left hand for progression, and the right hand kind of pulls out the melody out of those chords. So. As a three-piece band, we try to fill it out as much as we can, save Brian's playing bass and got that all locked down. But if I'm not at a place in the song to loop, doing that kind of tapping frees up some of one hand. If I have a chord over here and I can pull out a melody. So it's just another way of kind of making the most of a three-piece, I guess. Okay, so yeah, for say, Death Rides a Horse has similar thing to that. We're all laid down at simple tapping riff and then augment that with chords. And so that crap's happening, so that's a simple loop that I can throw other chords on it. That's a very forgiving loop. It's kind of a drone in D, so I can play stuff in that key and mess around with that, and it's pretty easy to get around with. So typically writing the songs, you hear the notes. I'm sure for most guitar players, musicians, they know what they want to do. It's like, okay, now how do I do that? What will take to, I got to move my finger like that? Well, that's not much fun. How do I do this? So it's mainly just following, you know, what you hear and kind of like trying to make that happen. It can be difficult at first. So once you finally learn the song, oh, that's how to play it. Okay, got it. So it's just a matter of getting the muscle memory down and learning the song, because sometimes it's not the most conventional way of playing, you know? So you've got to realign your brain. If fingers are going, it's no different than a pianist, I suppose. You know, they got different things, taking care of your bass up here, or, you know, treble up here to kind of lead, so.
Can you show us a little bit of Carpe off your first record?
Mm-hmm. So as far as, that's more of a clean thing. So I have something, more of a polyrhythm happening. So you have something like, so you have that kind of go in the background, and then again it's a polyrhythm here, so I'm not sure what's happening, to be honest, but two pretty simple things happening there, but at the same time, it creates a weird, kind of interesting rhythmic thing happening there. So that's another thing of just having bandmates say, play that apart, and okay, let's try that, and just multiple brains coming together and working on stuff. So it's not just the same old, oh, here's a tapping part, great. That's when you, tapping can be a nightmare, you know, so so much crap out there, you know, and not that I'm doing anything special by any means, but yeah. God bless bandmates for editing their band members, I'll say that.
And now we have Brian Cook, the bassist in Russian Circles, who is going to run through his studio and live rig with us right now. You want to go ahead and start with your amp rig right here?
Sure, yeah. Well, I got a 8x10 Ampeg SVT cabinet. Bought this in, I think, 97, so it's been through quite a bit of touring.
And this is the 8x10 that was on all the Botch records and all the stuff you did for These Arms Are Snakes, right?
Yep, same cabinet. I've always had this one. Some of the early Russian Circle stuff, I was actually using an Emperor setup because I still had this out in Seattle. But when Snakes were finished, I shipped this out so I can have my preferred 810. And I usually run that in conjunction with Varelin Meat Smoke. Varelin being out of Seattle, made by our friend Ben Varelin. Usually when I play live at this point, I also use the SVT-3 in conjunction with an Emperor 412, although the 412 and the SVT-3 are just just for stage volume and not in the house mix. So it's just a way of having a little more speaker action on stage.
And what is it about the Varroa Meat Smoke that drew you to it tonally?
Yeah, it was loud, and it had a nice, sort of tube warm sound, the warm tube thing that you always hear people talking about. I've actually always really liked the way the SVT3 sound, but I feel like sometimes when you get them into the mix with things, they kind of disappear and you get just a bunch of clack or like low end, but not a lot of presence. And with the Varroa, I feel like it kind of had the whole sort of frequency spectrum kind of covered. So.
Sort of fills out the sound a little bit more. We've got your pedals set up, which is pretty expansive. Can you kind of run us through what your core live setup is and also what additions and subtractions you've made for recording the new album?
So the constants are always the whammy and the pog, because I do a lot of stuff with, adjusting the octaves on things, being, a three-piece instrumental band and, trying to fill up as much sonic space as possible. I actually just started adding this to the live show. This is a big bottom. It's made by a guy in Brisbane. I run my distortion through it, and it keeps all the low end clean, and you can sort of adjust the amount of effect and the amount of low end. I use that with a Fuzzrocious OC Demon, which is kind of like a full tone OCD, as well as a Fuzzrocious Rat Tail pedal, which is kind of like a old vintage Rat, but with a few additional little perks on it. Both of which sound great on their own, but with the big bottom, it gives a little extra thump. And using Swollen Pickle for fuzz, speaking of low end, I mean, that one doesn't need the big bottom because that thing is just like bass central, But for this recording, I've just been using a lot of this Eau Claire Thunder, which is modeled after the old green Big Muff pedals. And it's been working out really well. We've kind of had the luxury of time here in the studio, and so it's, figuring out which fuzz sounds best, which distortion sounds best, and it's been nice to be able to play with things and figure out what works. So,
and speaking of which, I know you have a couple more pedals here on your board, but I want to touch upon how electrical and recording here, obviously all the gear that you guys get to play with when you're recording at Electrical Audio, what you've used from their stash and how that's helped you add new elements of texture and sound to the record.
They have no shortage of cool old amps to try out. I've been incorporating the old Trainer TS-50 for sort of alternate bass tone. It's a cool little grindy tube amp. It sounds like a lot of the bands that have come out of here,
so it's got a really, really aggressive tone to it. And that was the amp that was used for all the bass tracking on Geneva, right?
Yeah. For that record, we split the signals. We had two amps. We had that, and then at an SVT-4, it had a couple of SVT-3s, and one of them got lost in the mail when I was shipping it out here. And the other one, the transformer, just fried. And so I upgraded to an SVT-4 and realized in the studio that I didn't really like it all that much. So the Trainer TS-50 came in really, really handy on that recording session.
And so from the that pedal right there, you're running into this Ernie Ball Volume Jr. and out to the Memory Toy and into the Akai Headrush. How often have you been using the Headrush in the studio, and how often do you use it live for your set?
Well, usually live, I have two purposes. When I can, I really like the tape echo simulator on there, and that's kind of my primary delay that I use. Looping, there's a bit of looping live, particularly when we're sort of bridging between songs, and we'll build little loops and tiny short songs out of them in lieu of us talking or engaging with the audience. So, I mean, I use it for looping basically on every song for that reason. But, really primarily I just love the tape echo function on it.
There's also these really awesome looking little pedals here that look like they're running on watch batteries. Can you give us a little detail on them?
Yeah, that's a company called Tone Butcher out of I think they're out of maybe Costa Mesa. So they're out of Southern California, and it's just a weird little sort of hobby this guy down there does, and he's not even really specifically guitar oriented. He's almost more of a noise sort of circuit bending kind of noise nick dude. So, but they're great fuzzes, great little filters and whatnot. And Yeah, they just get really crazy tones.
They oscillate pretty easily, right?
Yeah, and that's kind of the thing that I really like about them. We used it a lot on Empros just because you could get them to do these sort of weird pitch shifty arpeggios if you dial them in right. You could even kind of, we were getting it to a point where it was making a scale that was falling in line with the song. And I don't know, I loved it for that. It's a little hard to get it dialed in perfectly for a live set, but...
So what's the difference between the three tonally? I mean, obviously they all look a little bit different from one another.
I can kind of walk you through what each one is. This was just a thing called the Pocket Puss, and it runs on a watch battery. And it's a fuzz, and it's a really kind of distinctive, really compressed fuzz. Based on sort of how you have it set, it'll do the sort of weird arpeggiating, pitch shifting thing I mentioned. It's really a really trashy sounding fuzz, and it's maybe not like the most practical fuzz to have as like your sort of primary driving force, but I've used it a lot on this record we're working on just because it has just like a crazy texture that I don't know of any other fuzzes that really kind of come close to it. And then this one works in conjunction with it. I believe this is called the Wee Wah. And it's kind of just like a weird filter thing. I think it was supposed to sort of emulate like an auto wah type of thing. But it almost sort of works in the reverse where it, you know, kind of starts with the high end and pulls it back into a low end function.
So it ramps down.
Yeah. And this is like a weird, it's like a ring modulator. And then also he attached a little oscillator on it, so you can, it's kind of two independent things, although I guess you could run this into the ring modulator if you wanted to, but you have three little parameters that you can work with, and volume, and it's just a little tone generator. This is a fun one to dial in. Again, when it's used in conjunction with those, they play very well together. Cool. And then actually this one I use live all the time. This is sort of one of their larger scale ones, and this is a Blue Whale, and again it's a fuzz but also has a tremolo function that you can engage, and this one runs on a standard battery, obviously. It oscillates in a really cool way, and you can just turn one knob and write these little melodies with it, just based off of the feedback.
And what's the company that makes it again?
This is Tone Butcher as well.
And we have a Dwarfcraft pitch grinder over here. I know you're a pretty big fan of that one.
Yeah, that's another exciting one. That one takes up a lot of real estate, obviously, on the pedal boards, but this is an arpeggiator, like pitch shifter thing. The Soms I've been using live quite a bit, and it's just a pedal with three oscillators built into it and a little joystick to adjust one of them. And so it's just a noise generator. You can dial in some pretty cool drone-y stuff with it. So I've been using that for interludes and whatnot.
And can you tell us a little bit more about the Verlin?
Yeah, you know, it's a great fuzz. It kind of reminds me of like the old Super Fuzz pedals. Nice, thick, defined fuzz. Great pedal. Again, been using it on the record. So I kind of just cycle through pedals here in the studio, finding out which one works best for each part. So it's going to be tough when I have to actually like have one pedal board and
figure out how to replicate it all live.
Yeah, take it out on the road. So
we got one more Fuzzrocious pedal at Ram the Man Parts here.
Yeah, Ryan at Fuzzrocious at some point learned the Botch song Man the Ramparts was, our code name for it was Ram the Man Parts, and I guess he thought that was pretty amusing, so he decided to name a pedal after it. Yeah, it's a really cool sort of gated overdrive. It's kind of I don't know if it's necessarily overdrive or fuzz.
Borderline between the two?
Yeah, kind of depending on how you have it dialed in, it does different things. But, really cool sounding pedal.
And then we have this beast over here, the Moog Taurus.
We picked it up after we did the Empress record because we got a little too overambitious on the overdubs and realized we either needed to have like an extra player on stage or we needed an extra set of appendages to take care of root notes, and it's worked out really well just because, you know, if they're just being me and Mike covering the melodies and having so many layers, it'd be tempting to try and fit it in all the time and overuse it, so I kind of made a point of, you know, trying to hold off on how much I use it, but it just winds up working out.
So here we got your main bass, which is an old vintage Gibson Ripper. Can you give us any extra detail about it?
I can't tell you what year it is because I don't know. I've been trying to figure it out for a while, and there's been so much variation in like the serial numbers and whatnot with the old Gibson basses, so it plays nice. It sounds good. It
sounds great. That's all that really matters.
Yeah, exactly. Owned a Grabber for years. I bought back in the late 90s and toured with forever, but the pickups corroded out on it, and the neck was pretty warped. It was hard to play. So, yeah, I kind of went through a series of other basses. I had one of the new Grabber reissues for a while, but the pickup sound was pretty different, a lot darker, not as much high-end definition in it. And I was playing a first act Delgada for a long time, which I actually really liked, but I missed Gibson's, so I got this one off of a friend for a good deal, and I've been enjoying that.
And then we have a custom-made first act baritone.
Yeah. They'd offered to make me a custom bass, but I already had one of their Delgada basses, and I liked that a lot. Yeah, it just kind of seemed like it would make sense to have something in between the guitar and bass range, so we used it a little bit on the Empress record, and we used it on Skipple and a couple other tiny overdub spots. But it's been in heavy use on this record.
Some detail on the inlays, which are really awesome.
Yeah, well, I figured while I was going custom, I might as well do something kind of outlandish. I figured since it's a baritone, I'd put a couple of bears in the inlays. So I also figured it'll help prevent theft. So no one's going to want to steal a guitar with a bunch of fat naked dudes on it.
What tuning do you put your baritone in?
It's just B standard. Yeah. Mike's been doing a lot of stuff on this record in some weird drop B tuning. But I'm just so used to playing in standard tunings that I wanted to kind of keep it simple. Right. And that's sort of where I'm most comfortable with. So
thanks a lot, Brian. Yeah. Appreciate your time. Looking forward to hearing the new record. The new Russian Circles release will be out this fall. And to check out more videos like this, subscribe to the PremierGuitar.com YouTube channel. Again, this is Jordan Wagner, and you're watching PremierGuitar.com.